の日と晴れとどれが一番好き？曇り。あ、同じだ。
So I'm at New York Anime Festival 2009, talking with Simon Richmond. You're the author of The Rough Guide to Japan.
That's right, The Rough Guide to Japan and The Rough Guide to Tokyo and The New Rough Guide to Anime.
Which is, it's pretty amazing, because when I was in Japan, we used The Rough Guide a lot to get around, like, through the whole country. And then I read most of The Rough Guide to Anime. Like, I skimmed through it. I especially read descriptions of some of the anime canon I hadn't read yet. But here you can just tell people about the book.
Well, it's basically a book that it's a little like our travel guides in that when you pick up a rough guide, it's an introduction to a country or a city. It tells you everything you need to know about that particular place. So imagine that anime is like a country. And so we break it down into the things you absolutely need to know. And the core of the book is my choice of the best 50 anime of all time that you, if you're a fan or if you're getting into anime, you really should try and see. So that's the heart of the book. Around that, we have a lot of things that will help you understand why those anime are so good. So there's an introductory chapter on the history of anime. There's a chapter on all the different people who are involved in making anime and the key creators. There's a chapter on the different genres of anime. So all the different, you know, like sci-fi and horror and fantasy. And then there's also a chapter on manga, because obviously quite a large percentage, about 60% of anime are based originally on manga stories. So we wanted to sort of give people an introduction to that, because it has a longer history than anime itself. And then we also look at how there's a lot of sort of cross-cultural pollination of anime. You know, like anime has influenced a lot of animation around the world, but anime in itself was originally influenced by animation from the West. And that, you know, it's sort of come back to the West, and now it's got, you know, things that have happened in the West are going back to Japan. So there's this really interesting sort of developments there, and then how anime is actually sort of broadened out to the wider culture. So you've got anime influencing music and art and, you know, computer games and things like that.
Like how that one Madonna video was like she looked like she was dressed like Mello from Death Note in this strange coincidence.
Yes, yeah. And there's the Britney Spears one as well, which is, you know, like she's sort of in Ghost in the Shell, you know. So, yeah, people love to be, you know, as you know from coming to these type of conventions, people love to dress up as their favorite characters. So, yeah.
So, The Rough Guide to Anime has some advantages over, well, it's different from other anime books on the market in so much as,
It's not as heavy. I mean, there are some really great books out there that, you know, have absolutely everything you could possibly ever want to know about anime. I'm not mentioning anyone in particular, but
it doesn't weigh as much as the Anime Encyclopedia.
No, it doesn't. No, and it doesn't cost as much either. But no, it's more concise. It's more, you know, it's not exactly pocket size, but it's definitely a concise version of things you need to know. We don't really miss an enormous amount out, really.
I was going to say it's a bit different in so much as a lot of those books are written by fans or people who watch anime for a long time, but you didn't start watching anime until 2006.
No. Well, it's not entirely true, Aaron, actually. I think I remember it. I told you this before, that I started watching anime when I was a child, but I didn't realize it, and I think a lot of people were like that. You know, when I was a kid growing up, you know, in the... There was cartoons on TV, and they were in English, and so you just think, well, it's an English cartoon. But if I'd really paid attention, I might have noticed that some of the names on the credits at the end weren't exactly English sounding. They were sort of, you know, basically Japanese. So, you know, I think the very first anime I would have seen was one called Marine Boy, which I don't think many anime fans today would know about. But
I know, because I was reading about it today because Tomino, who's like the Gundam creator, is a guest here. And so I was like, oh, if I was going to ask him something, I'm asking about Marine Boy. That sounds good.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to seeing him as well. But that was like the seminals of anime that I watched as a kid. And Yeah, so we watched. I watched them, but I didn't really realize. And then I did. I mean, I lived in Japan for several years in the early 90s, and the anime was all around me then. And you know, the movies of Hayao Miyazaki, which I love, and really sort of what brought me into this into closer connection with anime and wanting to write more about it was watching films by great artists like him. I saw all those, but I didn't do what many of the people at conventions like this do, which is, you know, download anime or just watch it on a daily basis, you know. But then to write the book, I had to be like that. I had to watch a lot, yeah. which was no bad thing.
Like nonstop for
sort of nonstop, yeah. Now my partner thought I was sort of going a bit crazy, but it was fun. I mean, it was fun. It's not the way I would want to live my life all the time, but it was really like going to a different country for 6 months, just in the same way that I might go to Japan and, you know, travel there for 6 months and write about it. I visited Planet Anime for 6 months.
But it is like another planet. I'm gonna save this file because.
Hey guys, we have to tape a promo for our show. In 20 seconds, tell us what the Anime Roundtable is about.
Well, the Roundtable is about a Canadian perspective on issues revolving around anime, manga, and fandom. As well, we got the bullets, and why not some final insults to send it all off?
5 seconds left.
Really?
Lollies, Nazis, train molesters, bakake, and the women that love them.
Time's up.
Really? See that?
Well, it is uncensored. It's the Anime Roundtable, the official podcast of Anime North. Look for us on iTunes, Podcast Pickle, or your favorite podcast directory. Or look us up online, www.animeroundtable.com. The Anime Roundtable, where we edit for time, not content.
So in your anime canon, I don't know, being a geek myself, one thing that my friends would sit around and do in college is make long list of, you know, top 10 films by Miyazaki, top 10 whatever anime movies of all time, and so forth. But there were certain rules to it. Like, if you had a movie by, if you're doing a top 5 list or something, and you could only include one movie by one director, and you couldn't really repeat. Because if you say top 10 anime movies of all time, you know, like, 10 of them are going to be by Miyazaki, and maybe you can fit, like, one more in. But your canon of 40 films and TV series, it does include almost every Miyazaki film.
Not everyone.
Which one is it?
By Miyazaki? Let me think about that. Well, I mean, there are ones which are elsewhere in the book. Ponyo came out a bit too late, really, for us to do a full review. To be honest, I mean, I wouldn't include it as one of Miyazaki's best films anyway, but I think it's a very sweet film. There's a shorter review for it elsewhere in the book. Future Boy Conan is also reviewed elsewhere in the book. But yeah, I'm just trying to think whether we did miss any of his... Oh, and you're probably right. I don't think we did. I don't think I did.
I mean, I would do the same thing if I was...
I mean, I make no apologies for that. Right. I mean, there is a reason why Miyazaki is considered the sort of, you know, this deity of anime in the anime world, although he would be the very first person to say that he doesn't make anime, he makes animation. And to me, as a film lover, above all else, I mean, he is a great filmmaker and he's a great storyteller. That's why he is the person he is, and I make no apology for including all his movies.
No, I know. I just think it's kind of funny, where it's almost like a sort of shorthand that's like, well, there are 40 slots.
I do also include, I mean, and I feel a bit sad about this. The one thing I want to say about this is the person who loses out is his creative partner Isao Takahata within Studio Ghibli, and I do include quite a few of his films in the canon, but not all of them, because again, his work is a bit more specialized, and so it's not going to appeal to us a wider audience. But if I was pushed to say what my favorite anime of all time is, it would be Isao Takahata's Only Yesterday.
Yeah, I like that one as well. But yeah, Takahata's films are really great, but there's something like The Sound of Ocean Waves, not really my favorite. Like, I think I may have watched it at the wrong time, but it didn't really strike me. I think you have to be in a different point in your life to really enjoy that film. In any case, and so you talked to a bunch of experts and stuff to write the book.
Yes. Yes, Helen McCarthy and Jonathan Clements, who are the authors of the Anime Encyclopedia. I interviewed both of those. They were very generous with their time. There's also a little short sort of interview in the book where they list their favorite and their worst anime of all time, which I thought was great because what we were trying to do with this book as well was just give people a shortcut to really watching the best in anime because there's so much rubbish out there. And Helen and Jonathan are the first to admit it because they've watched pretty much them all. I watched a lot, but they've been watching it for years and years and years and continue to do so. So I mean, they really are the absolute experts on this. But I met a lot of other people as well. A lot of people like Justin Savakis from Anime News Network, who writes regularly on that website. He has a great column called Buried Treasure, which I would recommend anybody who's sort of getting into anime to go to that site and look at those reviews because they're very intelligent he's a real fan, but he's an intelligent fan and sort of can do good critical work on that. I was in touch with Fred Schott. I also met with Giles Poitras, who's written several books.
His
main job is a librarian in San Francisco, but he's done a couple of introductory anime books, which are a little bit old now. So, and I think that's also what we were trying to put something that was a bit more up to date. And this book was published this year, but the last part of the book, which is about how to get hold of anime and what's happening in the whole download world, BitTorrent, that type of thing. It was very difficult to write that because it was all changing so quickly at the time that I was doing the research. And quite a few of the companies at the time that were big have now actually gone out of business entirely. And, that's just sort of, it's interesting, to sort of see that. And even just to the talk that we just attended from Funimation, who were sort of, they were a big player at the time, but they've become huge now because they've managed to sort of find a way through this very difficult sort of landscape of changing sort of technology and changing patterns of, people not buying DVDs but downloading it from the internet or watching it streaming online. And they've managed to come into that and make a very good business of it. So I'm great to see that anime sort of thriving in the USA through that sort of route.
Yeah, it was the Funimation panel. They talked a lot about how they have their YouTube channel and Hulu and Xbox and any whatever download to own and watch it for free and nonsense. And they seem to be doing quite well.
Yeah, and I think 2 years ago when I was first getting into this, people were really a bit sort of, they were like deer in headlights. They didn't really know which way to turn or what to do because they were still sort of on this mode, oh well, we must sell DVDs, and they paid a lot of money for licenses as well, so they were all like frightened they weren't going to make any money back because things like Crunchyroll were just coming up and sort of starting to it was fans sort of beating the big players to it, really.
Yeah, so. It's been kind of a strange and crazy ride at conventions because I think when I really started going in 2002, maybe in 2002 and 2003, a panel like that would be all announcements of licenses and people screaming and some giveaways, and then it kind of turned into this collapse as the DVD market went under, and then it turns into being more like what companies are left and this kind of gloom. And then Funimation is the last man standing and with a couple other companies. And so it's more like now we've acquisitioned this from failed company Genion. But then they are repackaging it in ways where 3 or 4 years ago fans were like, here's what you need to do to succeed. You need to have it almost aired at the same time as UN Japan. It has to be online for free. You can't just pay for it. And it needs to be season box sets because American TV shows were really killing the market with season box sets of HBO shows for a really low price point. And anime, at 3 episodes a disc, it just wasn't going to work.
Yeah, everybody who's producing DVDs, not just anime ones, are learning these sort of lessons. And if you just look at the way the market's developed in Japan as well, there it's all about if you buy a DVD, you really want to have something value added. And it was interesting that they were talking about the Evangelion release there. They weren't even bothering with the 1.01. They were just going to the 1.1 and blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is real, sort of geekydom type stuff. But, the people who are really into anime in this way will want to get these particular versions and, want all the extras and want, I think also he was saying that on one of their internet channels, there was an opportunity to actually look inside the box and see what you were getting, which I thought was really great, because that's a really fantastic way of marketing. it's not just enough to watch it online. You want to actually own it and own something special that's, you know, better than that and that's very high quality.
So you're not really doing a book tour, you're just going to some cons?
No. Well, I mean, Erin, as we've previously discussed, I mean, my main job is actually as a travel writer. So I'm traveling anyway. Yeah, and I've recently been in Korea and Malaysia this year, which are both very, you know, they're really into anime and anime. Yeah, Korea has its own sort of animation industry anyway. So it was good to sort of be in that environment and to sort of hook up with people there. I actually went to an animation museum in Seoul.
Oh, I went to
Have you been?
Yeah, Noah and I went to the Animation Museum in Seoul, and we went to their manga library, and yes, it was very funny because at the front,
these kids sitting on, and they were watching Japanese animation, which, you know, like they were watching Hayao Miyazaki movies. Yeah, so.
Oh yeah, but they asked us. We were with our friend who was teaching English in Korea, and they asked us for our school IDs, and we're like, we don't have school IDs. Can we come in if we show you our passports? And then we felt sort of like, because everyone there was like junior high or younger. But in the very back, there's like the glassed off section for adults. And so they had all the art books and also all the American comics were on a single shelf in the very, very back.
Well, you obviously had a bit more time to browse than I did. I was a busy travel researcher for Lonely Planet, actually, that time. And so I couldn't... You know, I very much wanted just to stop for the day and watch, you know, watch all these wonderful DVDs that they had. Yeah, no, next time I'm in Seoul, hopefully on holiday, I'll spend a little bit more time there.
Did you also have to go to the Korean Cultural Museum?
I went to a lot of museums.
The one where you get on a bus and you go outside of Seoul and there's like a village that's set up.
Oh, the Korean folk village. Yeah. No, that's cute. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, don't make people.
Because I've gone and then like the producer of the show that I was working on, it was the show, the cartoon show I used to be working on was animated in Korea. And so one of the reasons I went was to tour the studio while I had a chance. And that was great because I got to meet like people who had been working on The Simpsons since season 4 and like other, so, and they also worked on the SpongeBob movie like while I was there. So that was like really neat. And then our friend who we were staying with, they were like, well, you have to go to the Korean folk village. And when I talked to the producer of the show that I was working on, when he'd gone to Korea and he'd only been like twice or so, they also dragged him out to the Korean folk village.
Like for Everland as well.
No.
You didn't go to Everland?
No.
That's quite fun. That's like the Korean version of Disneyland.
Was it Lotte World?
Yeah, well, there's Lotte World, which is actually in Seoul itself, yeah, which has, you know, Lotte and Lori, who are these, you know, these vaguely Mickey and Minnie-ish, but they're not mice, they're cats. And actually, I went to, there's a hotel attached to Lotte World, so the Lotte World Hotel. And they have like these themed rooms on two floors for kids. And they're very cute, but there's a rather eerie life-size, you know, versions of Lotte and Lori lurking in the corridor, you know, which I think would give most kids nightmares.
We drove past it, but we didn't go to Lotte World. I think we were only there for a week.
It's very kawaii, very kawaii. I think people, yeah, kawaii, yeah, kawaii, not kawaii. But, yeah, maybe both, yeah, kawaii and kawaii. Cute and a bit scary at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. So you're traveling like all the time, like as part of your job?
Yeah, well, not, I mean, at least 6 months of the year. And I'm actually going to be going back to Japan at the very end of this year and the beginning of next year to do the next editions of my rough guides to Japan and to Tokyo. So
is that just like an update? Like, do you go back to
places? We about every 2 to 3 years, we update the books because things do change. And people want new information, so that's, you know, it's the time has rolled around again for me to do that. And yeah, I'm looking forward to, because it's such a dynamic country, and, you know, it'll be great to sort of catch up. And there's a new government, you know, unfortunately, they're probably going to can what I was looking forward to, being able to go and find out about a new venture the previous government were promoting on an island, a man-made island in Tokyo called Odaiba. They were going to be doing this museum or a center devoted to the new arts, so anime, manga, you know, digital gaming and those, yeah, digital art. But it became quite a controversy during the government's during the recent election, and the Democratic Party, who have just been elected, made it a campaign pledge that they would not go through with this museum. So it looks like that's not actually going to happen, which I think is a great shame, because it is one of these real growth areas for Japan. This sort of you know, it's popularly called Japan's soft power, but the sort of content industries in Japan, which anime are part of, are really, you know, a great sort of income source for the country. You know, it's not just about them producing, you know, Toyota cars and Sony PlayStations and, you know, that type of hard product. It's also about the intellectual property that people want. And yeah, I think a lot of fans would have gone there. I know this summer, I mean, they had this life-size version of Gundam on Odaiba, which I really wanted to go see.
I was sad. I went to Tokyo Anime Fair, and it was like the base. No, the base of it was set up, like, that's where it was going to be, and it wasn't unveiled yet. So I missed it. But my friend who's living there saw it and took pictures and all that stuff.
No, it was very frustrating because, like, I was actually, I flew, when I went to Seoul, I flew via Tokyo, but I didn't really have enough time to get in and out from the airport just to see it. But
it's so huge, you could just take the monorail by.
I should have just delayed my flight by a few hours.
I missed my flight. I'll need to get the next one.
Oops. Right. I think it would have been worth it just for the photo op, I think. But the funny thing is, actually, I don't know if you read this, but the Koreans, Korea and Japan have always been, for many centuries, actually, have been great rivals. Don't really want to get into the history of that on this podcast, but during the 1960s, when they still weren't that friendly following what had happened during the war, there was a ban actually on anything Japanese really coming into the country, including anime and manga. So what the Koreans actually did was that they just ripped everything off and they created their own sort of versions of Gundam. And Taekwon V. So since the big success of this life-size Gundam in Tokyo, the Koreans are also going to be building one. They're going to be doing that in their own sort of theme park somewhere.
It's like they have to.
They have to. That's national honor.
for competition. That was the really kind of funny part about the Tokyo Animation Museum. They had this lineup the Seoul Animation Museum, where they had a lineup of the most popular Korean cartoon characters from each decade.
Strangely familiar, don't they?
Where it's like, oh, this is a ripoff of Gundam, and the next one was a ripoff of, and like it went kind of down the line for whatever was popular in another country in each decade. There was like a Kenshin ripoff looking character, and the most recent one, there was like a Korean Simpsons version. Like there was like a Bart Simpson looking character who was on TV when we were there, and it seemed as if after so many years of making the Simpsons in their country, they had like ripped it off and done like a Korean style family drama with the similar character set except for more Korean jokes.
Well, you can hardly blame them, can you, really?
I mean, they saw something that was successful and it could work with their country, a couple of Korean jokes, and there's I really enjoyed my time in Korea. Now I work near Koreatown in New York. My new job is in the Empire State Building, and so it's right near 32nd Street. But it's just such a thriving kind of wonderful pop culture, and
I used to live in Japan and I spent a lot of time traveling throughout the country, and this, although I have been to Korea before, but it was only briefly, this was my first sort of concentrated period of time there, and it was really revealing to me because there are a lot of similarities between the two nations, and that is not surprising because they share centuries of history and they're very close to each other.
The flight is like an hour.
They're really close cousins, but also very, very different on many levels as well. And I found the whole energy of and approach to life of Korea completely different to Japan and very refreshing. And I think if anyone is familiar with their sort of cartoon world, it's called manhwa world, they would find that reflected in that as well. I went to an electronic game show while I was there as well, because Koreans are hugely into sort of e-games.
Where it's like internet cafes are jam-packed with like online players. Their bandwidth is amazing.
So there's a game that they play called StarCraft where the Koreans are like number one in the world, and they have several TV channels just devoted to.
We watched one that was so amazing because it was like an MTV studio with two guys with like their hair done up but dead serious playing StarCraft. And like the narration was like a sports narration, and now the Zerglings are rushing or whatever they say.
It's like watching WWF fighting or something. There's like big explosions and flashing lights and these kids. I mean, they are kids, and most of them are burned out by their 25.
They have to retire like athletes. athletes.
But you know, they're like, you know, pro football players. You know, and they're treated the same way. They earn a huge amount of money. They're sponsored by the biggest of Korean corporations like SK and LG and whatever. In fact, even the Korean army has their own. I think it's either the army or the Air Force have their own StarCraft team. They
would, because that's who, like, I think that it's 2 years of required army service for Koreans, so they would, yeah.
So that's one way that they get, you know, they've decided to, you know, make it cool, right. A little bit cool for
them. Well, the U.S. Army here sponsors video games as well. Really? Oh, yeah. Like, there's a free army game that you can download, and because it's that age group of young men in their early 20s, the Army and Navy, the Marines, advertise very heavily during Adult Swim and that kind of thing, because it's like, that's who joins. So yeah,
I suppose it makes some sort of sense. I hadn't really thought about it, but if you're into sort of like online role playing or video games which involve military tactics or fighting with each other, then you can appeal to people to come do it for real.
Yeah, or there's the kind of, is getting ridiculous off topic, but there's the kind of now the army looks more into, like, because people are fighting like with drone planes and things, there's more of a kind of, there's an avatar kind of aspect of war playing. I mean, not war playing, of war, that's like gameplay. Yeah.
Tactile enough and agile enough in your the way that you think and you move your hands.
Yeah, that you actually do need those kind of skills now to pilot like remote crafts and things like that. So they do kind of recruit people who are like it's like that movie, The Last Starfighter, like the people who are really good at the army video game are recruited.
So this whole sort of idea of like teenagers sort of like piloting giant robots to save the world is actually not that far from reality, really, is it?
Well, it's getting closer all the time.
Yeah, scary.
So that's it. So you've been going to American cons for what, a couple of years now, or?
Yeah, a couple of years. Yeah, since I started the. I mean, that again, that was something I didn't do in my past life, but I have started to do since I took on research of this book, and I enjoy them immensely. I mean, it's you know, it's like entering a whole other world again for a few days, and to see people so passionate about their particular hobby or, you know, their interest is great. I think.
What was the first con that you went to, and like, if you'd been researching the book up to that point, I want to know what was that impression like.
That's just right. Can we stop?
Oh, you're gonna look it up. Okay. I like that you have to refer to your own book for facts about your life, because I've done that as well, where it's like, no, it's okay. Someone, because people ask me things about, well, when did this and that happen, and like, I have to look back on my own live journal to be like, oh, that was 2004, or once to find like the start date of a job I'd done, I had to like look on my blog to find.
I tend to just keep in my mind whatever I'm working on at that particular time. So if you ask me what was, you know, what stuff to do with Korea, I could tell you, but
or we could talk about Malaysia, but you've forgotten where we are.
Even that's sort of fading. You know, it's like I have these intense bursts of activity on things, and then it sort of just fades away. And yeah, I need to sort of like balance out my life a bit more and have, you know, more, a little bit of anime, a little bit of Malaysia, a little bit of Japan. So the, you know, the very first con I actually went to was AmeCon, which is held in the UK in the University of Leicester, Midlands town, Leicester, and that's actually one of the biggest, if not the biggest, con in the UK. About 2,000 people go to, and it always sells out.
Oh, only 2,000.
I know, so small. But in the UK context, it's actually quite big. looking at my book now, I see it's actually 1,300. It's even smaller than that. So the smallest one in the UK is called Minamicon. It's held in Southampton. Minami, obviously meaning south. Southampton's a port town in the UK, and that only has 300 attendees. It's deliberately kept at 300, and that's like, it's like the Fabergé egg of cons in the UK. People fight to sort of get, you know, to be allowed to go to that one. So there was no way I could go to that one, but the Leicester one I sort of managed to sort of like wangle my way in. And it was a revelation, because it was the first time I'd sort of spent a whole weekend around all these people who dress up and are really into sort of just living the character. But just to be able to sort of watch anime end to end, like I would eventually end up doing, but then to be able to talk to people about it who have, you know, these great opinions and really want to share their enthusiasm was just a really nice feeling.
I'm still thinking about the really small con with 300. I mean, there because there must be like
there's a gap in the market, don't you think, for boutique cons?
Well, they tried to do like Well, there was like kind of a convention experiment disaster maybe last year where they tried to do an over 21 anime convention in Providence. Yes. And it didn't really...
Yes, I remember picking up some information about that and thinking, maybe I should go. But what happened?
It was really underattended and it wasn't handled very well. Like, the organization was sort of bad, like... Parking was really expensive. The artist alley. My friends who went stayed in the artist alley, and it wasn't well. They didn't do well, and only like they didn't sell enough tickets to make the money back for the con, and it was generally bad news. Or you could only. I think the real problem was that you could only buy a 3-day pass. You couldn't buy a single day pass, which is too bad because like there are a lot of universities around. But in
I don't think. I mean, I think in the concept is a pretty good one. Maybe the organization wasn't great. I mean, it's sort of quite telling that the New York Con that we're at is organized by Reed Publishing. I mean, they're a big. You know, this is their major business, and it's probably the most professionally run con. It's not really a con. It's more of a sort of trade fair in some ways.
But really walks that kind of industry border,
it is a weird amalgam, and it has a lot of con elements, but it's a hugely more professional than most of the type of fan organized ones that you would go to. And
what's creepy about it's not exactly creepy. What's weird about this con in particular? There were a couple of years when New York went without having a convention, and it was because no company was big enough to like really sponsor one until Reed stepped in. Then having the existence of New York Anime Festival means that some industry people here, like Viz, don't go to the fan cons like Otakon anymore. They just come here because they don't have to travel as far. It's much easier to plan. So it's kind of really, its existence has kind of drained the larger fan cons, which is weird.
Well, I can see that being a problem, but I think, again, there are... horses for courses, really. I mean, this type of event, it can happen in New York because a lot of the companies, they have a presence here. There's a big fan base here. Yeah, they're going to get the numbers just because of the type of place New York is. Something like a Baltimore con or a sort of Midwestern con where it's a lot more local. That it's more difficult to attract people to come there. It's going to be
the real problem with
for the fans, and it's an opportunity for those fans who can't travel to the big cities on the seaboards to come together and enjoy themselves. And
I mean, this one in particular tends to be really young because it'll be kids who live in the city and can just take public transit. Whereas Baltimore, Otakon is like a real expenditure because it's only 3-day passes. You kind of have to drive in. It's only downtown, so you kind of get an older crowd there. And here you get teenagers.
Yeah, you would get teenagers. But I've seen quite a lot of adults walking around as well. And I think that's one of the really nice things about these cons as well. You see a lot of kids coming with their parents. But the parents are into it as well.
Yeah.
It's something that families can share.
Yeah, that's been something that's come up a lot in the last couple of years, especially at the 2 years I went to San Diego Comic-Con. It was like people pushing strollers with their next generation of geeks. It's very adorable. and so the manga complete guide comes out, and you did.
I did contribute to the manga guide, and I think it's been a little delayed. I think it's now coming out in October. But I really don't know that much about it because I'm not the main author. Jason Yado, he's a journalist based in Hawaii. There's been a little bit of publicity, but I mean, it's definitely not in the shops at the moment.
Okay.
Wenn ich mit dir springe, tanzt mein Herz mit. Wir sind verschieden, doch das ist egal. Akpakutugyu, Akpakutugyu.